KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
For 50 years, the State Ombudsman's Office has been assisting Alaskans with wide-ranging requests related to government services. From advising on government ethics codes to investigating the state's Child Support Division, veterans' land sales, mariculture, and a host of other concerns, the Ombudsman helps elevate the voices of everyday Alaskans when they have a complaint with or seek change in government services. What have these public servants helped change over the past five decades, and what do you need to know about their mission? We'll discuss the public advocacy work of state and local government ombudsmen today on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, maintaining and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com. Did you know 100 years ago, the chances of a baby dying in Alaska before their first birthday was almost 10%? Because of advances in public health like sanitation, access to clean water, vaccines for children, and access to health care in rural communities, the chances of dying are now less than 1%. To learn more about what the Alaska Department of Health is doing to improve Alaskans' health for the next 100 years, visit health.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello. From Alaska Public Media, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. How much do you know about the public advocacy of the Ombudsman's Office? The state office's website states that in the 1980s, ombudsman services were provided to local governments of Wrangell, Ketchikan, Juneau, and Palmer. Offices in Juneau and Anchorage remain open. Today, the state office cites between 1,600 and 2,400 requests for service per year. So what are some of those requests, and what have state and local ombudsmen helped Alaskans with through the years? Here to help us better understand the role of this public advocate is the State of Alaska Ombudsman, Kate Burkhart. And also, Kate joins us from KTOO in Juneau, our partners there in the state capital. And also with us in the studio in Anchorage is the Municipality of Anchorage Ombudsman, Daryl Hess. Thanks for being here, both of you.
Thank you, Laurie.
Good morning.
Thank you, Kate. You can also join us, Alaskans. Have you received assistance with a government problem through the Ombudsman's Office? Do you have questions about how to get help and what services the office provides? You can call us statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. So, Kate, I want to have you start us off here. Governor Jay Hammond signed the Alaska Ombudsman Act on April 14th, 1975. It went into effect the next day. What's known about what was going on at the time, why the act was put in place? Was it driven by the public, or how did it get started?
There was a movement across the country around that time to establish these kinds of neutral investigative ombudsmen at the statewide level. So there are five now in the United States, and each was created around this same time. There was a lot of public discussion about the purpose and role of the ombudsman and how it could assist Alaskans in navigating bureaucracy and systems within the state. There was some concern about the role and whether it would actually promote more efficient and effective government. But generally, the consensus was that it would provide the public with an avenue to resolve issues in a way that was beneficial to individuals as well as the government agencies that provide those services. So there was a lot of discussion about jurisdiction. So classical ombudsman, this model is typically within the legislative branch and has jurisdiction over the administrative actions of the executive branch and doesn't have jurisdiction over the decisions of the judicial branch. And so it fits squarely within that idea of the separation of powers and the balance of the three co-equal branches of government. Ensuring that the jurisdiction of the ombudsman was such that it supported that separation of powers while also promoting more effective and responsive government to the public. That was a big part of the conversation back then.
I was surprised to find out that there's only 5 states that have ombudsmen. I just wrongly assumed that all states had them. What's known about why there's so few?
I could not speak to the other 45 states' decisions. There are quite a few agency-specific ombudsmen around the country. There are a growing number of child protection ombudsmen, folks whose jurisdiction is exclusive to the child protection system and the agencies involved in child welfare. There are states that have ombudsmen embedded in their correctional systems or that have jurisdiction exclusively over the correctional agency. So some states, while they don't have statewide ombuds like Alaska does or Hawaii or Iowa or I think it's Arizona and New Mexico, they do have this role for the agencies that often have the most direct impact on people's lives. And for us, those two agencies, the Office of Children's Services and the Department of Corrections, are the agencies we hear the most about every year, year after year. And it's because they have such a direct impact on people's lives.
The state ombudsman's office in Fairbanks closed in 1995 after the budget was cut in half in the 90s. Are the offices in Anchorage and Juneau the only state offices that are open today?
Yes. So our staff is divided about half and half, one office in Anchorage and one office in Juneau. We are a statewide organization. Over the last 7 years, we've really prioritized outreach, particularly to rural Alaska, because we don't hear as often from folks in those communities as we do from folks in the Anchorage Bowl and Juneau and Fairbanks. So we have spent time on site in Kotzebue and along the Kenai Peninsula and Bethel and Sitka. We're going to have folks doing outreach at the gold medal basketball tournament here in Juneau later this month because we serve all Alaskans. And it's important for us to get out to the communities where we don't have offices so that folks can learn about us and can access our services.
After that big cut in funding in the 90s, has the budget stabilized for the state office?
For the most part, yes. I mean, just like any other public agency, it is affected by the fiscal health of the state. But for the most part, we have had a stable financial resources and I'm most grateful for the fact that we have stable staff resources. We have a very low turnover in our office. We have folks who spend, you know, sometimes their whole career with our organization, which provides a level of consistency and institutional knowledge across administrations so that we're able to really dig into systemic complaints and to be able to provide insight and history to programs that, you know, kind of wax and wane as administrations change. So we're pretty fortunate.
Kate, I use the word advocate in the opening comments, but you said in a previous interview that an ombudsman is not an advocate.
We are not.
You investigate issues, but would you say you're sort of a advocate for the truth, sort of like a journalist?
If we are an advocate for anything, we're an advocate for good government. So it is very important and essential that the ombudsman be objective. That is the bedrock of our profession. If we're not objective, then we can't establish the relationships and trust needed with complainants and agencies and witnesses to actually get to what happened and why it happened, and for folks to feel comfortable being frank and honest with us in our investigations. We don't take sides. We don't advocate or take the position of the complainant, and we don't advocate or take the position of the agency. our decisions are based on the evidence. So wherever the evidence leads is where the ombudsman's findings arrive. So I think if we're an advocate for anything, it's for good government.
All right. Thank you. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska. And today we're talking about 50 years. This year marks 50 years of the State Public Ombudsman Service in Alaska. In the studio of KTOO in Juneau, Kate Burkhart joins us. She is the State of Alaska Ombudsman. And in the Anchorage studio with me is Daryl Hess. Daryl is the Municipality of Anchorage Ombudsman. You can join our conversation if you have questions or you've availed yourself of ombudsman service and would like to talk about that. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. That's 1-800-478-8255. In Anchorage, the local number is 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Daryl, thanks for your patience. I want to turn to you now. You noted in an earlier interview that Kate was just talking about an ombudsman not being an advocate, but you noted that ombudsman means protector or defender of the people's rights. How do you employ that in day-to-day practice, and do you see your role as somehow different from Kate's?
The only difference between Kate's role and my role is the scope. Our office only has jurisdiction over municipal agencies, employees, and agents of the municipality who provide services to the public on behalf of the municipality.
So contractors would be under that purview?
Certain contractors, if they're like Anchorage Animal Care and Control, the Anchorage Safety Center, Anchorage Safety Patrol, because they're providing services to the public on behalf of the municipality. But I think you hit the nail on the head earlier. We, and I agree with Kate, we're, if anything, we advocate for good government, for fair government. So as far as it's, when I look at the meaning of the word ombudsman, which is defender of the people's rights, it's a Swedish term, we're advocating for, we're defending the right of the public to good government, fair, impartial, good government.
All right. Kate noted that, as we discussed earlier, only five states have a state ombudsman. Do you have a lot of municipal counterparts across the country, or are
no.
they rare?
No, they're very rare. You know, I've always been puzzled why more states and local governments don't have an ombudsman's office. When you look at the cost of them and you look at the return for that relatively small cost, the return to benefit to the public, benefit to the government itself, I've always been puzzled why more locations don't have ombudsman's offices.
So Alaska was very progressive-minded when this was established so many
yes.
decades ago and has kept these services all this time.
Yes, we were ahead of our times. Our office, you know, the conversation with the state and government, Governor Hammond was in 1975, and that was the year that the people of the city of Anchorage and the greater Anchorage area borough voted to unify and create the municipality of Anchorage, and in the Home Rule Charter, it says the people have the right to the services of an ombudsman, and I think it's item number 6 on the Municipal Bill of Rights is the right to the services of an ombudsman. So the state and the city of Anchorage were pretty progressive at the time.
Mm-hmm. Kate, turning back to you, you described your role as classic ombudsman, and there are some different types. How do they differ, the different types of ombudsman?
So the classical ombudsman is the model that Daryl and I have described. It's that objective, governmental, investigative kind of ombudsman. Every state does have a long-term care ombudsman, and that is an advocate. The long-term care ombudsman advocates for those who live in assisted living and nursing homes and other kinds of long-term care settings. So they are focused on solving problems and protecting the rights of folks in long-term care. And that is required by federal law. Every state has a long-term care ombudsman. And the Alaska Long-Term Care Ombudsman does great work here. There is also an organizational ombudsman. an organizational ombudsman, you find them in universities and corporations and within state government, within federal government agencies. And they serve more of a, I guess, human resources role. So they are the folks you go to as an employee or perhaps as a grant recipient or a contractor with that company or agency to resolve a conflict or a problem. They do not conduct investigations. They are very focused on conflict resolution and communication between the parties. And so that is a different model as well. So those are the three main models. Sometimes you'll see folks want to apply the label of ombudsman to other kinds of conflict resolution roles. And I'm pretty protective of that. Like, this is a very specialized profession, and we do something very specific. And so not every conflict resolution organization or professional would be an ombudsman. Just like our office, we have in the past done some groovy conflict resolution, but our bread and butter is investigative.
And so your oversight over administration actions of government agencies, what is that level of authority? Do you investigate, and can you then mandate change or only suggest change?
We can recommend change. We cannot force an agency, a state agency, to do anything, and that's appropriate. First of all, the Alaska Ombudsman is not an elected official. This is a position appointed by the legislature. And second of all, I talked earlier about the co-equal branches of government. So it's not really appropriate for the ombudsman to be able to force a state agency to do something. That's not our role. We work very hard when we do find that a complaint is supported by the evidence and something went awry to make recommendations that are practical and achievable and that add value to the services of the agency. And we work with the agency on those recommendations so that they make sense and they resolve the complaint. That helps make it easier for the agency to implement the recommendations. But the agency can always say, jump in the lake, we're not doing that. And that's fine. That's how it works. We do have the option to issue a public report of our recommendations if we believe that that will help the agency implement the recommendations, or if the agency has declined the recommendations and we believe that they still need to be implemented, so that the folks that can make that happen, which is the legislature and the governor's office, and the people. Popular support is really important too. So we will issue that public report with those recommendations to move those forward if that's appropriate and if it is going to work. Very rarely do we do that. Maybe 1 to 3 or 4 times a year do we issue a report, because our goal is problem solving and improving services. It's not report writing. And so we invest heavily in the process and the relationships with the agencies so that when we do make recommendations, they're more likely to get implemented and we just solve the problem and move on.
About half the time a public complaint that comes into your office, Kate, is about government, and half the time it's not. Describe what type of concern you can deal with. I realize they're quite wide-ranging. And then how that differs from what Daryl's work is.
So our jurisdiction is over the administrative actions of state agencies. So those can be big actions like the decision to issue an oil lease, or the decisions made around how oyster farmers have to have insurance, or things like that, a grievance policy that doesn't work at an agency. And those can be small decisions, like the decision whether or not to change a foster care placement, or the decision of whether or not someone got their permanent fund dividend this year. So we can investigate big decisions, small decisions. We don't investigate decisions that are made at a at a political level. So sometimes, like there have been times in the past where the governor's office has made decisions about the permanent fund dividend, and we will get lots of calls. That is not an administrative action. That is a policy decision by a political official, and we cannot investigate those kinds of things. Mm. And we also get decisions from folks who are unhappy with what a judge has decided in their case. And that is not something we can investigate either. That's not an administrative action. That's a judicial decision. So that's where our focus is the decisions agencies make, big and small, that have a direct impact on Alaskans. And then the ones that we get that aren't about that, which can range from I'm being evicted and I don't think my landlord is being fair, or my neighbor's chickens are too loud, or my road's not being plowed and it's a city road, those kinds of things. I think it's really important that we don't say, no, we can't help you, and end there. So we work really hard to know where all the resources are and the appropriate agencies are that can help solve those problems, so that we say, that's not us, but here is who it is. And we make that connection. So the next call they make is hopefully the last call they make.
All right. Thank you, Kate, for that. Daryl, turning back to you, as Kate noted, also, a lot of the issues that come to your office are not under your jurisdiction. People call with complaints about something that you have no purview. How do you describe to people what you can address?
The first thing we do when somebody contacts us, we listen to them, we hear what their issue is, and we determine if it's jurisdictional. This is the same process that Kate and the state ombudsman's office goes through. And if we determine it's not jurisdictional, we have the same philosophy as the state ombudsman's office. We don't want to tell people we can't help you, goodbye. So we would try to figure out the resources, nonprofit, government agency, state agency. Frequently we refer people to the state ombudsman. We refer people to the long-term care ombudsman. We connect them with a member of staff with the congressional delegation. So we've established relationships with our congressional delegation offices, state legislators' offices. So we, different nonprofits, and we try to figure out, just like Kate, how can we get this person some assistance.
So sometimes it's just making connections to the actual entity that can help with a particular issue.
Correct. Last year we had contact with, I think it was 1,449 individuals. We only opened 233 cases. So for the majority of those individuals, we referred them out. Or we have people that want to file a complaint about the Anchorage Assembly, the mayor, or the school board, and we are prohibited from code by investigating the actions of the mayor, the assembly, or the school board.
Interesting. Where can people go then if they have a complaint about those bodies?
Depending on what the issue is, there's the municipal ethics board. You can start a recall campaign. You can run against them. You can support another candidate, but they are elected officials, and our office does have jurisdiction over elected members of service area boards, and Girdwood Board of Supervisors, but not the Assembly, School Board, or Mayor. And a lot of people get upset when we explain that to them.
Mm. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and today we're talking about the fact that this is the 50th year of public ombudsman service in Alaska. Alaska is one of only five states that have a statewide ombudsman. We also have in the studio with us, we have Kate Burkhart on the line from Juneau, and Kate is the State of Alaska Ombudsman. And in the studio in Anchorage, Daryl Hess joins us. Daryl is the Municipality of Anchorage Ombudsman. So we have state government and city government ombudsman on hand with us today to answer your questions. You can call us statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email talk@alaskapublic.org. Let's go to the phones for a moment. Stu is in Muldoon. Hello.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I would like to thank the ombudsman, the municipal one, especially. They are often the only people that actually answer their phone. When I call a lot of rural offices, it's voicemail only. And I just called because the rumor line has it for the park near my house that somebody froze to death. And I got the ombudsman helped me out. They sent me the APD records, and it's just a rumor. Nobody froze to death in the park near my house. So thanks for having people actually answer the phone, and I'm learning a lot. I looked it up in the dictionary. It says Sweden and New Zealand for what they had in my old college dictionary for where this concept started. But, yeah, thanks for that. Love the show.
All right. Thanks for the call, Stu. We also have an email from Julia in Eagle River, and she says, hello, I'm listening in live today. I want to say thank you for the work you do to both the state and municipal ombudsman and their offices. Thank you for mentioning the long-term care ombudsman. Each of these ombudsman's offices do work that can be difficult but is so important. So a couple of comments there about the importance of the work of the ombudsman's office. Kate, you said that 99% of the work that is done will not be released to the public. And I understand the need for privacy with certain complaints, but why isn't there more public-facing information so people do know what they can bring to your individual offices, especially after five decades?
I'm going to take that in two parts, and I'm going to start with the second part first. So we do publish our success stories and an annual report every year that highlights the work of the office. And we do quite a bit of outreach, including a periodic newsletter that explains what we do, how we do it, why we do it, how to make a complaint, all of that groovy stuff, because it is important. It's one of our core strategies for achieving the office's goals that every Alaskan knows about the ombudsman and how to contact us, because that is important. The reason for confidentiality, first of all, the confidentiality associated with our office is in statute, and it is not a privilege. It cannot be waived. The ombudsman shall maintain the confidentiality of complainants and witnesses and matters that come before it in an investigation, and we're only permitted to release very limited information for the purposes of moving forward our recommendations. Why is that? It's because why would someone come to my office and tell their story, their very personal story about their involvement with the Office of Children's Services because they need help with a problem with OCS if they don't have confidence that we're going to keep that confidential? And why would staff at an agency tell us the truth if they don't know that that's going to be confidential? We cannot do our work. We cannot conduct a thorough, objective investigation if folks don't feel like they can talk with us. It's also important for the resolution of problems. We're much more likely to get to a solution and resolve a complaint if there's confidence that the agency can move forward without having to worry about things like their deliberative privilege being breached or personal issues being aired publicly, those kinds of things. Mm. So it really is as important as our objectivity is that confidentiality. We also receive complaints that would fall within the protections of the Whistleblower Act. And while we have a Whistleblower Act, and that's really important, the remedies available to whistleblowers who experience retaliation from their public employer as a result of talking to our office or another public agency are really hard to access. They have to go to court themselves. And so in order to protect the person within the agency who brings a complaint to us, that confidentiality is really important. And then retaliation by an agency is something that many people are concerned about, especially families whose children are in custody, people who are incarcerated. Whether it's accurate or not, that fear of retaliation is real. Mm. And so we need to be able to respond to that by saying, you know, your identity is going to be confidential. Your complaint is confidential. There are times we can't investigate if someone is too afraid to allow their name to be released. The example I use is, Kate didn't get her permanent fund dividends, so she calls the ombudsman to say, I want my permanent fund, but don't tell them that I'm complaining. Well, I don't know how to investigate that complaint without saying that Kate is the one who didn't get her PFD. And so sometimes the confidentiality makes it a little hard to do the work if the person doesn't want to reveal their name.
All right.
But that's why.
Okay, thank you. We'll drill down on that a little bit more after we take a quick break here as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The South Central Alaska Subsistence Regional Advisory Council will meet to develop federal wildlife proposals and discuss other subsistence-related issues. The public is invited to participate in the meeting March 12th and 13th in Cordova. More information at doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing 50 years of public ombudsman service in the state today with Kate Burkhart, the State of Alaska Ombudsman, and Daryl Hess, who is the Municipality of Anchorage Ombudsman. You can join our conversation at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email talk@alaskapublic.org. Daryl, you had mentioned in a previous interview that people can withdraw a complaint, if they don't want their name to be part of the information released to the department that they have a complaint against. Are these decisions and the records ever available to the media or the public through records requests?
Per municipal code, our investigative files, our work product, are not public records. So even if we acquire a document that is otherwise a public record, if it's part of that work product, that case file, it's not subject to a records request because it's part of the file. We, as with Kate, with the state ombudsman, if the name of the complainant is absolutely essential when interacting with the department. If we need to disclose their name, we have to give them the we have to advise them and give them the opportunity to withdraw the complaint. However, if there's a wider issue that we see, we can initiate an investigation on our own initiative. If it's a policy or process or a procedure that we think there's an issue with, we can investigate it outside of having a complainant come to us.
Okay, so the records are not ever made public. Can the complainant, the person who initiated the process, could they at some point say, I have records of all this, I'm going to make it public?
Sure. There's nothing in the code that prohibits a complainant from contacting the media or posting on social media. With the previous municipal administration, I believe there was a suspicion a couple of times when the media got wind of an investigation I was doing, and they assumed I had contacted the media. It wasn't me, it was the complainant. Unfortunately, we can't control what the complainant does. And they think it's helping their cause, but frequently it's not productive for the complainant to contact the media or go public during an investigation, because then the departments become more reticent to talk to us.
Kate, when a government complaint or issue does arise, what is the process? If somebody comes to your office bringing something forward, talk about what happens then. What does that trigger?
The first step is talking with our fabulous intake team. We have two folks who are, they touch everything that comes in the office. So they collect all the information about the who, what, when, where, how, what happened, who did you talk to at the agency, what was the agency's response, what do you want to happen to resolve your complaint, what evidence do you have, what documentation do you have. They collect all of that. We review new complaints every week on Wednesday mornings and determine what whether it's appropriate for investigation, whether an investigation would result in some kind of remedy, what our resources will allow, and then an investigator or team of investigators will accept the complaint for additional review and investigation. Many of our investigations are conducted within days or weeks. Our benchmark is 12 months for the more complex ones. We hit that most of the time, not all the time, but most of the time. Our investigations involve a lot of record review. We rely heavily on the administrative record, the records from the agency that support their decisions. We interview witnesses, the complainant, folks at the agency. We will also talk to experts if it's about a matter that is outside of our normal areas of expertise. We collect and assemble the body of evidence and review it, and then make a finding, a decision, based on a preponderance of the evidence, which means it's more likely than not that the allegation that the agency made a mistake or did something unlawful or unfair or any of our other standards is supported by the evidence. We share those preliminary conclusions with the agency, and that's required by the Ombudsman Act, so we have a consultation process with the agency. And that's an opportunity for the agency to say, well, but you didn't consider this, or here's some additional evidence, or, you know, we read the statute differently. We have that conversation. Sometimes that changes our findings. Sometimes it doesn't. We'll have a conversation about ways to resolve the complaint, and then we will issue, if appropriate, we will issue formal findings and recommendations in a confidential report to the agency. And then a redacted, like, summary kind of report to the public. I will say a lot of our complaints are resolved with two phone calls and an email. Somebody has a child support complaint where they feel like the child support enforcement division is collecting too much or not applying their payments to their arrears correctly. We'll have somebody work through the records from child support and any records the complainant has to figure out if the math is right and if they're following policy and law. If they are, we will explain that to the complainant. If they're not, we will talk to the agency to figure out where the rub is and ask the agency to fix any mistakes and to move forward from there. That does not result in a report. That results in a resolution, and we explain that to the complainant and to the agency, and we close it. So that is, by and large, how most complaints are resolved, through that investigative and informal conversation with the complainant and agency. We don't do shuttle diplomacy, though. We're not negotiating some sort of resolution. We are making a finding based on the evidence and then moving forward from there.
There's so much going on behind the scenes. For both of you, the fact that there's so few ombudsmen, both on the state level and the municipality level, with so much of what you do sort of hidden from the public and from policymakers, does it make it harder to make the case to keep these offices staffed and running? Do you face budget threats on occasion because of the fact that a lot of what you do isn't public facing? Daryl, how about for in the city?
Our budget has been pretty steady over the last few years. There was a time, you know, a decade or more, over a decade ago, when there was some angst with the performance of the office, and instead of addressing the issues, the solution was to cut the budget and cut the staffing. So rather than fix the issues, I think we've moved past that. The assembly And most mayoral administrations have been very supportive of the Municipal Ombudsman's Office. When I was appointed 12 years ago, almost 13 years ago, I had 1.5 staff. Now I have 2 full-time, so they've increased our budget, they've increased staffing. But it is still a lot of work. 233 cases, 1,500 contacts with the public. It's a lot of work for 3 people.
Mm-hmm.
So we stay pretty busy.
Yeah. And Kate, how about for you? Are there occasional threats to the budget for the Ombudsman's Office?
In my time and in recent history, it has been more about the financial needs of the state rather than threats based on the work of the Ombudsman. For us, we focus on outcomes and the benefits provided to constituents and the ability to resolve problems and avoid things like litigation. And so I think that by reinforcing that being able to resolve someone's problem relatively quickly, I mean, we are not fast, but relatively quickly, and in a way that actually addresses the issue, rather than having to have the person engage in long and protracted litigation or for the state to face class action lawsuits because of difficulties or poor performance of public programs. Like, that's a huge benefit to the state, to individual Alaskans, and there are cost savings there. So I think by focusing on the outcomes that Ombudsman services achieve, that helps policymakers see the value that we provide to both individuals and communities.
Kate, you're an attorney. How helpful is your legal training for this role, and what are the requirements for someone to be a state ombudsman?
So you do not have to be a lawyer to be an ombudsman. It's helpful in the office to have at least one person with a legal background. We have a licensed attorney on staff. We have an assistant ombudsman who served as a paralegal for the state for a long time. The most important qualifications are the ability to remain objective, to be able to communicate effectively, particularly during hard and emotionally charged conversations, to be solution-focused, and to have strong critical thinking skills. We have had folks with journalism backgrounds. The ombudsman before me, Linda Lord Jenkins, was a journalist. We have people with journalism backgrounds on staff now. We've had folks with science backgrounds, legal backgrounds. We've had folks that worked in state service, so they had that administrative expertise before coming to our office. Really, what needs to be in your toolbox is the ability to think critically and to remain objective and to be able to communicate effectively. If you've got those things, I think you have to have a sense of public service. Mm. That's one of our core values, is a commitment to public service. So if you have those things, you can be an ombudsman.
Daryl, how about for you? What was the training process like for the municipal ombudsman position?
There are no specific requirements in the code as far as education. I always make the comment that I don't even have a university degree. After 2 years, I dropped out and, you know, had some adventures in pre-pipeline era Alaska. I think it's the ability to read people, to communicate, to think critically, to read code and statute. When I interview people to hire them, something that's always a plus for me as far as experience is hospitality industry experience. I did food service management for 15 years, and then I was with Car Safeway for 20 years before going to work for the municipality 17 years ago. And somebody with food service, hospitality, industry experience, they're good at reading people. They're good at handling people, dealing with them. I think it's a lot of people may not consider that a plus, but I do. And I will say I've hired 3 people in 12 years.
Hmm. Yes, I can see why some experience in public facing positions would make sense, that that would help people better do that, better interface when people are calling in with concerns. We are going to take another short break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about the work of the Ombudsman as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If domestic violence has touched your life, know that you are not alone. You have the power to break free and build a future filled with love and respect. There's hope and help waiting for you. For free and confidential support, visit notaloneak.org to speak to someone who's trained to help. Every Alaskan deserves to feel safe. This message sponsored by the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Did you know 100 years ago, the chances of a baby dying in Alaska before their first birthday was almost 10%? Because of advances in public health like sanitation, access to clean water, vaccines for children, and access to health care in rural communities, the chances of dying are now less than 1%. To learn more about what the Alaska Department of Health is doing to improve Alaskans' health for the next 100 years, visit health.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing 50 years of public ombudsman service in Alaska today. We have on the line from Juneau, Kate Burkhardt. Kate is the State of Alaska Ombudsman. And in the studio in Anchorage is Daryl Hess. Daryl is the Municipality of Anchorage Ombudsman. You can join our conversation statewide if you have questions or comments or ideas that you think maybe would be something you'd want the ombudsman to address. You can call and find out if that's something you could take up with their office. Statewide, the number is 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. If you are in Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email talk@alaskapublic.org. Daryl, the top complaints that you get in the Anchorage office are usually against the police, development service, like land use and property taxes. Are these all areas that you can assist in?
Yes. Normally, I always like to tell the public, we are the caboose on the administrative train. So people need to exhaust their available administrative remedies through a department before we will look at it. And 95% of the time, those people do not come back to our office because the department takes care of it. So it's not really fair if we start looking at something and investigating, and the department says, well, but we haven't had a chance to resolve it. So one of the cases I remember, one of my first ones, was a woman was cited. She lived in a trailer court, and land use enforcement cited her for operating an illegal home business by holding too many garage sales. So the attorney for her, the trailer court where she lived for 35 years, sent her a certified letter that she was going to probably be evicted, because most leases say you have to comply with local, state, and federal laws. And she hadn't even been notified of this accusation by the municipality, because land use enforcement would only notify the property owners and not the tenants. So in neighborhoods like Fairview and Mountain View that are 80% renter, people were being accused of violating municipal code by the municipality and did not have a chance to respond. In this case, a lot of the notices for the garage sales that were posted in the court weren't hers. So she really wasn't guilty, and she didn't have an opportunity to address it. So we worked with the department. So now land use enforcement notifies the tenant and the property owner.
That was a win in a lot of areas, then, I would say, not just for that type of notice, but for all public notices.
Yes. There was also, we learned that if there was an application for a replat, a rezone, or a major product in a neighborhood, the municipality, the contractor, were only notifying the property owners. So once again, in Mountain View, Fairview, other neighborhoods, 80% renter, 80% of the people in the neighborhood weren't being notified. So we got them to change that. So now property owners and residents are notified. So the municipality over the years was sending a message to tenants that you don't matter, you know, to renters. You don't own your property, so you don't matter as much as somebody who owns their own home. And we've tried to change that culture over the last decade or so.
Mm-hmm. So important for everyone that lives in a neighborhood where some development or something is going to drastically change the neighborhood, for all folks that live there to know that.
Yes.
Absolutely. Kate, in an earlier interview, you mentioned investigating agency decisions that were, quote, based on inappropriate grounds. What does that mean?
Well, sometimes agency staff make decisions based on their feelings or perceptions and not on evidence or not on rules and laws. We did an investigation that resulted in a report several years ago related to the Office of Children's Services, where the agency halted a grandparent adoption. And the reason they did was based on feelings they had about the grandparent's spouse. There was no evidence, there was no information that supported those feelings, and yet they proceeded. And so that would be an example of an agency acting on inappropriate grounds. Like, I mean, I know we talk a lot about, you know, trust your instinct and trust your gut. Well, in government, that's not how it works. Like, you have to follow the law, you have to follow agency policy, and you have to, as an agency, be able to provide a reasonable statement explaining why you have made the decision you've made. Mm. And if it's feelings, that's really not going to cut it.
Yeah. We have an email question, and I wonder if this is something, this is someone asking about a baby being born that qualifies for Denali Kid Care. They've applied for it. Bills are piling up. Is that, because that's a federal program, but it is administered by the state, is that an area that you can help someone with, Kate?
Yes and no. So Denali Kid Care is the state's Medicaid program for children, and it's administered by the Department of Health, and so therefore is within our jurisdiction. However, right now, all complaints related to delays in processing of Medicaid, adult public assistance, and SNAP benefits by the Division of Public Assistance, we cannot investigate those because they are the subject of pending class action lawsuits. And once a matter moves into court proceedings, our statute says we cannot investigate. Mm. So for years, we were able to handle those kinds of complaints and either connect the person with the agency or work with the agency to resolve them on a one at a time basis. But since those lawsuits were filed, we've had to decline all of those complaints and refer them either back to the law firm that's handling the class action lawsuit or to the fair hearing process, which is experiencing its own delays. So yes, in the normal world, we could totally take that complaint, but right now we can't.
Okay, all right. Well, thank you for that. Daryl, you noted in an earlier interview that sometimes governments do things that don't seem fair or reasonable. Do you think it's mainly just bureaucracy that hasn't been challenged by particular cases, such as the ones the ombudsman takes up? And once it is, the confusion or lack of clarity can easily be fixed just because somebody hadn't thought through and challenged that particular quirk?
Or someone hasn't come forward and filed a complaint or raised a concern. One of the first cases I investigated in 2012, the woman was 84 years old. She contacted me. Her 85-year-old husband had driven downtown, paid to park, and he forgot to hang up his handicap placard, which says on it, don't hang from your mirror when you're driving. He received a $250 parking ticket from Easy Park, and there was no appeal process. You know, you couldn't waive it. You know, you can, you know, tinted windows, loud muffler, no driver's license on you, no insurance, proof of insurance on you. Those are correctable tickets. But this $250 ticket wasn't correctable, and I called Easy Park. Well, I referred the woman to the director. I said, they'll probably waive it. They'll make it, give you a warning. I went to the office on Thanksgiving Day. There was a faxed letter from this woman And it was Easy Park's denial of her appeal. I called them and I said, why won't you waive this? And they said, well, he had a similar violation at Jitter's Coffee in Eagle River 5 years ago, and you only get one free pass.
5 years.
So eventually I got the chair of the assembly, Ernie Hall, who represented the municipality on their board. He got him to reduce it to a warning. I issued a report. I found the complaint justified, even though nobody broke any laws. They followed the code, but I thought the code was unfair. So that's what I like about our office. We can file a complaint. We can find a complaint justified, even if the municipality follows the law, follows the rules, if we think they're unfair. I recommended changing the code to make that a correctable offense. Easy Park sent a 2-page email to all the assembly members telling them basically hell was going to freeze over if you did this. And Patrick Flynn introduced, I sent it to the assembly, you know, with an assembly memorandum. Patrick Flynn introduced the ordinance and it passed 11-0. So it is now a correctable offense. And I received a card from this woman. I still have it in my desk. And she said, thank you. You have restored my faith in local government. So when I have a bad day, I pull the card out.
That's great. So we only have a couple of minutes left here. And what, Daryl, start us off, what do you want, you know, like what are the top things that you want Alaskans, Anchorage residents to know about the services that you can provide for them?
Number one, they're free, they're confidential. And the only way government is going to change is if members of the public, when they think government has done something wrong or something isn't fair, somebody has to come forward and say something. You know, like the issues with the parking offenses or the notifications from land use enforcement and planning, those may have never been changed if those individuals had not come forward.
Before we move to you, Kate, I want to quickly get a call in here. We have somebody calling in from Anchorage who wants to remain anonymous. Can you tell us what you're calling about quickly, please?
Sure, I'll be very brief. I recall that the Ombudsman's Office has the authority to accept anonymous complaints, but they don't like to do it. It's the status of when this event occurred in the 1990s. But it was in honor of that. Plus, it was a sensitive complaint. The Ombudsman looked at a multi-member regulatory agency in Alaska and had questions, concerns about a particular member of that body. And they completed the investigation without result, but then they said the agency should have had unfairly failed to adopt regulations on the subject. And I thought, well, that's a really strange investigative standard. I wonder what all of the other standards look like. And I looked them up, and they didn't have any. Well, one reason they didn't is because I believe when a legislative or creative agency doesn't have to have regs. That's an executive branch creation.
We're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid. I'm sorry. Would have been great to have you call in a little sooner. Thanks for the call. Kate, any final thoughts here in about 30 seconds?
Just to add to what Daryl was saying and what one of the callers said. So we listen. We answer the phone and we listen. Whether your problem is jurisdictional or not, we're going to listen and we're going to help you figure out where to go if it's not us. And for a government agency, unfortunately, that's pretty rare to have the space and time to listen.
All right. Well, thank you so much to Kate Burkhart, the State of Alaska Ombudsman, calling in from KTOO in Juneau, and Daryl Hess here in the Anchorage studio with me, who is the Municipality of Anchorage Ombudsman. Thanks to our team today on the board. Chris Hyde helped us out with engineering. Our producer is Madeline Rose, and on the phones, Wesley Early helped us out today. And I'm Lori Townsend. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next Tuesday. Have a great week.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.
Programming on KSDP is supported by the Schumigan Corporation. Located in Sandpoint, the Schumigan family of businesses includes property and equity management, the Sandpoint Tavern, the Anchor Inn Motel, and the Anchor Inn Lounge. The Schumigan Corporation, serving its shareholders and the people of Sandpoint, on the web at www.schumigan.com or by telephone at 907-383-3525. The Schumigan Corporation, hometown values and service, a proud sponsor of KSDP.
KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay,